Om Parthaya Pratibhotitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Katitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. So we're on chapter 14, verse 23. Udasina Vadasinaha Udasina Vadasinaha Gunaryo Navichalyate Gunaryo navichalyate gunavartanta ityeva yovatishtati nengate udasina udasina vat asinaha gunaihi yaha na vichalyate gunaha Vartante iti eva yaha avatishtati na ingate. Remember in verse 21, Arjuna had asked Krishna these questions, you know. For a person who has gone beyond the three gunas, the sattva, rajas, and tamas, right? For somebody who's gone beyond these three gunas, he goes, how do they act? So somebody who's free of these, how do they act? Kim acharaha. And so now, Bhagavan is answering this. So he says, Udasinavat asinaha gunaihi yaha navijalyate. He says, yaha, the one who, yaha, navijalyate, is not rattled by, is not moved. Vichal means to move. The verbal root is vichal. Vichalya is a passive causal. So the one who is not made to become agitated or moved or thrown off, right, by these three gunas, that one who is asinaha, that one who is sitting as udasinavat, like one who is an udasina. An udasina is a person who is objective. In any given situation, an udasina is a person who's objective. They're not taking sides. They're not involved. There could be all kinds of turmoil going on, but the udasina is the person in that group who is really not involved in it. And so is objective, right? So sitting there, hi Tibbs, what's the matter? Sitting there, and here the asina means to be seated, to be placed. Placed where? It's not being physically placed. But they're physically seated somewhere. It's that because of their knowledge, their buddhi, their mind, is seated, committed to this knowledge, actually. It's committed to the viveka, the discrimination between my own presence, my own being, and all of the gunas, the sattva, rajas, and tamas, all of the gunas, the different types of thoughts, moods, emotions that are passing through the mind, the different states that the body is going through, the different states that the world is going through. That one who's, because of their knowledge, their mumukshutvam, their jignasa, jnana means that desire to gain self-knowledge. Because of that, they have a commitment, really, to recognizing my own presence amidst all of this activity. So seated, objectively seated in the self because of their commitment to that viveka, that discrimination, recognizing the self. Seated there with their mind because of the commitment, recognizing the self amidst all of these gunas, they remaining like an udasina, objective, remaining objective to these different thoughts and moods and emotions that come up. We have to refer back to the next verse, previous verse. He says, that person, that one who is avatishtati, they remain seated in themselves. They remain with themselves, right? Thinking, gunaha vartante iti. That iti means thus thinking. Thinking what? These are just the gunas. Gunaha vartante. These are just the gunas. These are just these sattva, rajas, and tamas, these different types of qualities that are passing through the mind. These sattva gunas, the thoughts that are predominantly sattva. Thoughts that are predominantly sattva means those thoughts where the mind is clear and bright and full of tejas and enjoys that sense of well-being and shanti, you know. Shanti means peace. Sattva would be, if we were thinking of a bucket of water, the water which was sattva would be very, very clear and still. In a sense, so that the sun is shining in the water would be clearly reflected. That would be sattva water. So sattva mind, when the mind is in that disposition, it's bright, it's light, it's attentive, it's very receptive to knowledge, it feels whole and complete. That's the sattva. Sattva, what we call the sattva guna, that's that particular quality. When the mind is rajas, you know, affected by the rajas guna, rajas means activity. And so rajas, say you have to have a clear bucket of water, which is sattva, and you drop a rock in it, it all of a sudden becomes ripply. That ripple, all of that ripple, the rippling, that's rajas. So when your mind becomes a little agitated, you know, or becomes irritated or angry or tense, say for instance, also just in a very simple way, if a desire arises in your mind, then the mind has a little bit of stress. Because now what you have is not okay. It may be okay, but you want something else. Right? It might be fine. You can be just fine, even if you want a glass of water. So you're sitting here and everything is fine, and all of a sudden you want a glass of water. I hope I'm not doing that to you. Okay. You want a glass of water, but now, right, there's activity. There's discomfort in a way, because the mind wants to do something. It has what we call a pravritti. That's rajas. Pravritti means a drive to go towards something. Or it has a nivritti. Pravritti and nivritti, this going toward or going away from, this is all kama, this is all desire, on a positive side or negative side. But the mind is a little agitated then, you know, or stressed. That's rajas. And so then if we say tamas, the mind is tamas, it means it's dull or it's tired or it's confused, you know, it's yawning, you know. That's tamas, you know. So here, in the previous verse, says this wise person, he says, whether it's prakasha, means whether that's the sattva guna. The mind is prakasha, means it's light, it's clear, it's shining. Or there's pravritti, it's moving towards something, the kama, the desire is there. Or it's moha, it's just dull and deluded. That's the tamas. So the wise person, when these three gunas arise, nidveshti, that person doesn't have hatred or dislike. He doesn't try to push them away. This moha, oh my God, you know. If my mind is going to think like this, then I'm no good. Or my mind is agitated, I'm not supposed to be agitated, I'm supposed to be a jnani. I'm not supposed to be dull with it. I'm not supposed to be an agitated person, you know. These things have to go away. I'm only supposed to be sattva. Okay, here's the sattva. Okay, this is how I'm supposed to be. So he says, the one who doesn't think like that, he said, these are just the gunas. Gunaha vartante. These are just the gunas passing through. It's not the wise person doesn't have a problem with these different states of mind passing through, because there's a viveka, a discrimination between me and all of these mental states. I'm not the mental states. And so that means, he says, when they rise, there's no hatred. When they go away, there's no desire for them to come back. Like say you have kind of a blissful vritti. It's all sattva. You see, all is well with me, all is so beautiful. And then, as, of course, it's being a vritti, being a thought modification, it will change and go away. And then you say, oh, please don't go, don't go. You know? So that type of thinking isn't there. And the reason that it's not there is because the sattva, rajas, and tamas, these qualities of the mind, by nature, they're coming and going and coming and going. The atma, your being, which is so complete and whole in and of itself, is never coming and going. The self is something that is the self of sattva. Your being, this me, this very simple, your own simple presence, your simple presence is the self of the sattva thought. And it's the self of the rajas thought. And it's the self of the tamas thought. It's invariable. So your being is not varying. It's not becoming anything. You're not becoming sattva. You're not becoming bright and calm. And you're not becoming agitated, and you're not becoming dull. You are free of all of that. And so here, he goes on from this verse 22 to this verse 23. That one who just remains seated as an udasina. Udasina means objective. I'm seated here, oh, this is a sattva vritti, this is a rajas vritti, this is a separate type of thought. Vritti means thought modification. This is a sattva vritti, this is a rajas, this is tamas, that's fine, it is what it is. There's nobody getting upset by that. So sitting with myself, that person who's able to do that, is not discombobulated, vichalyate, by these gunas. And thinking, that one who's thinking, these are just the gunas, gunaha, the gunaha vartante iti, thinking in this, and these are only the gunas, it's just the gunas. Then what? Yaha avatishtati, he remains steady. Tishtati comes from the verbal root sta. Sta means to stand, to remain. So he remains there, avatishtati, just that ava just gives rooted. He just remains rooted, na ingate, not being moved. He remains rooted in the self, in my own being, not being moved, not being moved back and forth by the gunas. No. This is the thing. Your mind, every thought that you have, or any given thought that you have enjoys you. You can say, we talk like this, this is my thought, right? And this thought of mine, this thought comes and it goes. We also know that every thought you have, it comes and it goes. But it is my thought, okay? Now this my, if we want to locate this my, what do we mean? Is that every thought that I have enjoys me, the conscious being. It is my thought, and I am the conscious being who has the thought. Okay? That's the satchit. I'm the conscious being who is the self of this thought. It's not that there's a thought over here and me over here. It's that this thought is my thought. When I say it's my thought, there is no distance between me and the thought. Like here's a conscious being, and here's the thought over here and some space in between. No, there's no space in between. That's why I can say, I am having this thought. When we talk, I am having this thought. This is my thought. And it can get even more of an identity. I could say, I am having this thought. Or I can say, this is my thought. Or I can say, I am the thought. Now, especially if it's an emotion, I can say, and we Vedantin might talk this way, but a normal person wouldn't. Because if you say, I am having sadness. I am having sadness. We don't say that. We say, I am sad. Right? I am sad. That shows that between me and the thought, there's a tremendous identity. I didn't think about, I am sad, I am happy, I am agitated. It means that these states of mind, these thoughts that enjoy me completely, because every single thought you have is me, it has for itself me, the conscious being, right? But the thing that we don't realize is that these thoughts that I totally take to be my own nature actually are coming and going in my own nature. They are coming and going in me, which is much different than being me. That's why when we do like a meditation, and we did the one we did today, was just to kind of deeply relax so that you can get rid of the noise of the agitated mind or the tense body. You get rid of the extra noise. And then you recognize just who's left. You know, you come more to the forefront as you relax away from the noise. It's not getting rid of the noise. It's just relaxing. By noise, I mean whatever thoughts are going on, whatever perceptions are going on, you just let them be, but you don't cling on to them. You just totally relax. And as you do that, not demanding anything of your body or your breath or your mind, you're just letting them relax, let them relax. What happens is your own presence, your me, the me, that who you are, is what starts to shine, right? Because the thoughts become diffuse in a way. And so your own presence, as though like a gestalt, comes more to the forefront. Even though it's always there in the forefront, it just becomes more noticeable. But what you notice and can see so clearly is that you are so inviolate. You're so simple, simply you, just simply me, without any type of change or disturbance at all. And that is who you are. Even now when you think of yourself, that sense of me that makes me me, when you meditate and become more calm, then the me that makes me me becomes more dominant. But it's the very me that is here right now. But we have to understand really that it's that very simple me is Brahman. That's exactly. Brahman is that very simple me. And by relaxing, it becomes more dominant. So, as one starts to gain knowledge and gain clarity, the mind more and more starts to differentiate its own activity, you know, from the ever-present stillness of me. It recognizes what kind of the mityatva, the maya, the name and form of its activity versus the constancy of my own being. There's no distance, there's no separation, there's just the mind's recognition of its activity in the midst of the constancy of myself. And now, the buddhi means your intellect, the part of the mind that's really gaining knowledge. It's the asinaha. It's sitting there in me, right? And the buddhi, having recognizing me, and kind of the inviolate nature, the self-evident nature of me, then becomes an udasina, becomes objective toward all of the gunas that are going on. And it's the buddhi, that's the one who has knowledge, that says, these are just the gunas. But when the intellect that understands, the one who understands that, so these are just the gunas, that one is rooted in, as are the gunas and everything else, in me, the changeless me. So sitting in me, the change, in the sense recognizing the changelessness of my own self, that buddhi, that mind, it says, these are just the gunas. Recognizing all the while that I, this very simple self that I am, is changeless. It doesn't modify or change in any way. I just simply remain there as the udasina, as the self of all experience. And myself, what's so beautiful about yourself is that whatever goes on in your mind, all of the good and the bad, the dharma, the adharma, everything that goes on, yourself remains as your best friend. Your being is non-rejecting by nature. And so your buddhi, say you make this mistake or that mistake, and your buddhi, your mind says, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or whatever it says, you know. It always has the support of your being, and that support of the being, that's a non-judgmental being. Your being is always the same. We're not used to that. We're thinking that if you do the bad thing, you know, then you have to leave the room. If you do a bad thing, then you have to go to jail. You do a bad thing, and so-and-so won't like you. You say the wrong thing, and you will be rejected. You say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, and you will be punished. And so we always have this type of, you do the right thing and you'll be rewarded. All of this, it's just terrible. It's very confusing. It's very hard to live in that type of an environment. Yeah. But the self is not like that. Your self is there no matter what you do. Your buddhi will try to correct dharma and adharma. It will try to go toward naturally. A healthy buddhi will try to go toward dharma and away from adharma. Because dharma brings shanti, peace. Adharma brings agitation. So just as we grow, as we go through maturing lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, and in this lifetime itself, we go on trying to improve ourselves, trying to be more caring, more loving, more giving, more understanding, all of these values that are across the board in every culture. We try to live up to these values more and more and more, because as we live up to them, the mind enjoys shanti. So we learn from experience. Right? And we notice that when we're angry or we're hateful or whatever the negative qualities are, that creates dukkha. It creates sorrow and pain in us. Right? So now, as we go through this learning process, what is the personality of the observing witness, the personality of the buddhi? When you do something, say you're trying to move toward dharma and away from adharma, trying to be a good person, not a bad person, trying to be kind, not angry, try to be loving, not critical. All of these things, you know, that we learn from our family and our religion and from others and from life, okay? Then how do you hold yourself as you make mistakes? How do you hold yourself when you do the wrong thing? And do you say something like, are you a critic? Are you a harsh critic? What type of inner voice do you have? Are you a harsh critic? Do you say, do you criticize yourself, or do you put yourself down? Or do you think that you're a loser? Or, you know, how do you talk to yourself? Yeah. Or are you kind? Are you kind? Do you say, it's okay, you know, just you'll do better next time, don't worry, it's okay. How are you? You know, it makes a huge difference to how you talk to yourself, you know, and how do you evaluate. What kind of inner voice do you have? Is the inner voice somebody that you would like to, is it somebody on your side that you would like to be with you? Is your inner voice somebody that you would like to be with you? Or is your inner voice like somebody that you would want to escape? It's a really beautiful question. That inner voice, the way you talk to yourself, is that like a friend, philosopher, and guide? You know, somebody who cares about you and somebody who wants to help and somebody who's your friend? Or is that inner voice a critic? Critical, mean, nasty. A lot of times we have that mean, critical, nasty inner voice that we really just get from childhood and wherever as we're growing up. But you can become conscious of it and you can change that. But now here, what I'm saying is that this is even a step. This is a step. Even beyond that, where when you recognize the nature of yourself is, I might say, the self of the kind voice. Say your buddhi is a compassionate toward others and toward you. Then what is the nature of the self of that buddhi? That nature is me. That nature is me. That nature gets kind of clouded by an agitated rajas or tamas mind, especially if I'm identified with it. Right? It gets clouded. But when the mind is sattva, when the buddhi is kind, you know, then I'm shining, my nature is shining in that buddhi. What happens when you gain knowledge is that the me is now becomes different, the buddhi itself, the mind itself, has differentiated me from itself. And so no matter what is going on in my mind, that supportive me is there. I can always bring my mind or my experiences back to what is by nature whole and complete and kind. And that's that sitting, my mind is naturally, the buddhi is just naturally sitting in that inviolate presence. By inviolate, I mean there's nothing you can do about it. You can do something about your mind. Your mind can become agitated. Your buddhi can become deluded. All kinds of things can happen to your mind. But nothing can happen to you. And so, because the self, your being is not an object to subject to change. And so once the buddhi has recognized that, enjoying my own light, you know, it functions. That's why the buddhi becomes, by nature, once... I'm circling around. I hope you're following me, but anyway, it's kind of a path. You have to be on this path with me to follow. Once the buddhi has discovered, kind of woken up, has seen this, has seen the self, recognized this, its own being, the truth of its own being, then enjoying that, it responds to the world. Enjoying that, it becomes the voice, in a sense, or the presence that relates to the gunas. It becomes udasina. It becomes udasina, it becomes objective. Because its self is the Atma. Its being is the Atma. And so then it is relating to the gunas, not being the gunas. So if I am the self, then these qualities that are going through the mind are the qualities that are going through the mind. The experiences and emotions that are going through the mind are there. They're there, but they're not me. Right? I've differentiated my buddhi has differentiated myself from them, you know, and that's what gives it gives so much freedom. So then he goes on further. There's three verses here. He goes on, and he's still talking about this kim acharaha. What, you know, how do they act? How does the wise person act? So he goes, samadukha sukha swastaha, samadukha sukha swastaha, samaloshtashma kanchanaha, samaloshtashma kanchanaha, tulyat priya priyo dhiraha, tulyat priya priyo dhiraha, tulya nindatma samstitihi, Dulyanindatma samstitihi. So, sama, dukkha, sukaha, swastaha, sama, loshta, ashma, kanchanaha. Tulya, priya, apriyaha, dhiraha, tulya, ninda, atma, samstitihi. These are some compounds. So, again, we're talking about the dhiraha. The dhiraha is the one who has a dhi, who has a buddhi, who has wisdom. The one who has self-knowledge is the dhiraha, nominative singular. So that dhiraha can also mean the one who is strong, the one who has fortitude. But in this context, it's the one who has clarity of knowledge. So he says, that dhiraha, that wise person, is one who's sama dukkha sukaha. The one who remains the same in sukha and dukkha. Sukha means pleasurable experiences or happy feelings. Sukha is like pleasure or happiness, and dukkha is sorrowful situations. So the one who is the same, because it's not that the situations aren't there. It's not that sorrow isn't there, a sorrowful situation. Or a happy situation, sukha and dukkha. The whole world is, you know, it's just like a parade of sukha, dukkha, sukha, dukkha, sukha, dukkha. It's not as though the wise person gets knowledge, and then all of a sudden, the only experiences we have are sukha. Says the Bhagavan says, now that you're jnani, for you, I'm going to change the nature of the creation. Now, creation stays the same, giving you all types of, what we call kind of the salt and pepper of life, all kinds of changing situations that are both sukha, positive, pleasurable, and dukkha, sorrowful. The one who remains the same. The reason that you can remain the same is not to say that those aren't there, but your being is changeless. The wholeness of your being is not subject to sukha and dukkha. So in the midst of whatever experience that you're having, the experiences are there, but you are not the experience, right? The experience of sorrow is there, but you are the fullness, the self that is having that experience of sorrow, right? So there's a big difference between your nature and the experiences that you're having. You know, it's just like Swamiji's used the example of, you know, say you're taking a ride in a car through the beautiful mountainside, and you're just enjoying the scenery. And it's so beautiful. You know, it's so clear out, and the scent of all of the flowers and the wildlife is there, and you're just enjoying it so much, and you're going winding road like this, winding. And then you go around this one curve, and you come into a garbage dump. Now the scenery has totally changed. Now you find yourself in the middle of this garbage dump. The smells are no longer beautiful. The sight is no longer beautiful. But there's nothing in your mind that says, I've now become garbage. Mm-hmm. It does not happen. You enjoy the beauty. It's not that you're not, you experience the beauty, you appreciate the beauty, and you experience the garbage dump at all also. But there's not an identification with it. You know, you don't become that. It's the same, you know, with the flow of thoughts that are going through the mind. Some are pleasing, some are sorrowful. They are exactly what they are. But you don't become that. That's viveka, you know. It's not, you have to understand, this is not dissociation either. You can think, oh, that they don't become their thoughts. She's dissociated, you know, as though you have to, some part of your mind has to run back into hiding so that these thoughts can take place, but I don't have to experience them. It's not that at all. It's that right now, at this moment, you are very present to every thought, every perception, every feeling that you have. Whatever it is, whatever the universe is presenting to you, internally and externally, in terms of the thoughts and feelings in your mind, in terms of your perceptions, these things are all taking place. The viveka, the discrimination, is recognizing that, yes, they are all taking place in me, who am always the same. Always whole, always complete. Simply me. There's nothing more simple, more pure, more whole and complete than just your own simple me-ness. The me, this sense of me. That never goes away, and it is inviolate, and it is beautiful. You know, that's what Rumi and all of the mystics, we always call the beloved. You have to, the beloved is this very simple me presence that never ever goes away. And it doesn't matter what kind of thought, it doesn't matter if you're going through the garbage dump or it's a beautiful flowers, it doesn't make any difference at all. And so, the one, that's how one remains the same, because one is always the same. It doesn't matter the scenery. It doesn't matter the emotional scenery or the external scenery, because my presence is always there, and also the refuge of all of that scenery. That's the other thing. For the buddhi, as the buddhi gains knowledge, whatever is going on in the manas, whatever is going on in the mind, the buddhi is rooted in me. And rooted in me, enjoying its own changeless self, it then is able to be present to this rotating sukha-dukha, whatever it is. So then he says, the one remaining the same in sukha and dukkha, that one is swastaha, with staying, to stay, to remain, swa, in oneself. That person is swastaha, remaining in oneself, then, because remaining just in your own being, then the sukha and dukkha, you go on experiencing. It's no big deal. Then, for that person, he is sama. Sama means the same. That one is the one for whom loshta. Loshta is a clod of earth, like a dirt clod. Ashma are stones, like rock stones. Kanchana is gold. So the one for whom a dirt clod and stone and kanchana are all the same in terms of value, It's not that a dirt clod and the gold, this is really all gold. No. This is a dirt clod. These are stones. These are gold. But none of them have any are any different in terms of my ananda. My wholeness is not dependent on is not dependent on the gold. And say if my ananda, I can say, say you have, you know, say you have those three doors or something like that, and you have to pick one. What's behind door number one? What's behind door number two? What's behind door number three? You have to pick one. Okay, so say, okay, well, door number two. I'll take door number two. And so then they open door number two, and it's a dirt clod. And then you think, I don't want the dirt clod. I don't want the dirt clod. Now say you get to try again. You open up. Okay, which one is it? What, you get one more chance. And you say, okay, door number three. You open up door number three, and it's the gold. Okay, it's the gold. Okay, so now ananda from the gold, fullness, happiness, joy from the gold. But the jnani doesn't think like that. The gold might be useful, the dirt might be useful, the stone might be useful for different things. They're useful. But my ananda isn't just dependent on the presence or absence of these things. You know, I might prefer getting the gold to the dirt clod. You know? Or I even might prefer the stone to the dirt clod. Who knows? I could have preferences. But my ananda is not attached to the stone versus the dirt clod. Versus the gold. That's the point. My ananda is dependent upon the atma. Ananda, fullness, wholeness, is dependent on its source. Where does the ananda abide? Does it abide in the gold or the dirt cloud? Where does it abide? What is its source? The jnani is the one that knows that the fullness that we experience in life, which allows me to say, oh, I want this gold, not the dirt clod. The fullness that we experience in life has nothing to do with the gold or the dirt clod. It has to do with my value system. If I believe that by getting this gold, I will become happy, then as I receive the gold, say I win door number three, I get the gold, what happens is my mind becomes quiet for that moment. I fulfilled a desire. My mind becomes quiet. This is for every desire you have. You fulfill the desire. Oh, got the gold. My mind becomes quiet. And then like the still water bucket, it reflects the sun. Like the stillness of my mind, that moment of the desire has been fulfilled. I don't want anything now because I have the gold. So for that moment, my mind is so still. And the ananda of my own being reflects in that mind in a special way. In a few moments, that stillness that was brought about by gaining the gold drops off. Really in a few moments. And what happens as it drops off is the ananda drops off. To the degree that the stillness of the mind, you know, comes back to its just regular state. The happiness that was brought about by the gold, you know, goes away. So really, happiness, the mental experience of happiness, the coming and going of the experience of happiness, has to do with only a quiet mind. Like if I have a water bucket reflecting the sun, you know, the sun seems so real in that water bucket. But what if I drop some dirt in it? Where it would happen to the beautiful, you know, clear sun. It's now all dull. It's lost its luster. This is what's going on with us all the time. We get to enjoy what we call little leshes, little trickles, little tiny bits of happiness based upon the moments of silence or shanti my mind enjoys. You know, but the shanti doesn't remain. And so it comes and goes. It seems that my happiness comes and goes. But what we need to differentiate and what happens as we gain knowledge is you realize that the The source of the happiness, the real wholeness, is your own being, just this me. And when the mind is relaxed, that me reverberates in that mind in a way that it doesn't when the mind is tense. But for the jnani, once you've differentiated the wholeness of myself, I don't need a sukha-vritti. I don't need to have a shanta-vritti, a peaceful vritti, or an agitated vritti, or whatever. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Because I've recognized the very essence of the wholeness that is always there, but is missed because I'm always seeing it in terms of through the lens of the mind, through the lens of the emotions of the mind. I've not done that discrimination. So for the jnani, that for the one who's differentiated themselves from these gunas, that samatvam is there. It doesn't matter what it is. It's a dirt or gold or anything. It doesn't make any difference because my ananda is not the same. Then again, he goes, tulya priya apriyaha. Priya, tulya means the same as sama, sama or tulya. Priya means pleasant, loving situations. Priya means if I'm with somebody and they're kind to me and loving to me, or I'm in an environment that's priyam, it means it's loving, it's peaceful, it's kind. Apriya means it's not, it's more hostile, you know. The one who is the same in both situations. That's actually harder because for the buddhi to have that type of, that asinaha, that being just sitting with myself, because you are always the same. But it becomes harder for the buddhi to remain objective when you're not being treated kindly. When you're being treated kindly, you know, it's so nice. You can relax and you feel happy and you feel welcome and warm and all that. But when somebody's harsh to you, to be able to maintain, as Swamiji will say, to be able to keep them outside, you know, that's a talent. But as you gain more nishta in your knowledge, nishta means clarity, then your mind enjoying your own, the stability of your own presence, can be present, can be like an udasana, can be present to you and your temper or your dislikes without taking it in. So the one who can remain the same, tulya, in both types of situations. And then he goes, also tulya, that diraha, one who is tulya the same in ninda and atma samstutihi. Ninda means if somebody censures me. Samstuti is praising me. Praise would be, oh, you're so wonderful. You're such a wonderful person. I just can't believe how good you are. You're just so intelligent. You're such a pleasure to be around. How do you accomplish as much as you accomplish? I'm just so amazed at that. What a wonderful, what a great person you are. And I'm so glad to know you. And the ninda is where you're censured, you know. Like, how could you have done that, you idiot? How could you do such a thing? What were you thinking? Are we going to have to do it? I don't even know if you can keep your job at this point. That's ninda, you know. How could you behave like this? What were you thinking? Who do you think you are? That's ninda, as opposed to samstuti. Samstuti is praise, right? So the one who doesn't really expect, you know, to be liked all of the time, you know, or doesn't expect that I need to be praised all the time, or that to think that people are not going to be critical of me. I mean, in life, sometimes people are critical of you, and sometimes they're very happy with you. And that's how it is. We have to be able to handle both. But what if you actually have your buddhi, your intellect, your one, that knowledge, the one who has knowledge, actually can absorb both, you know? That you can be praised. It's also a little embarrassing to be praised sometimes. You can be praised, but that's an embarrassment we'll put up with. Right? But it's harder to take real criticism, you know. But for somebody, as you mature in your knowledge, you know, that udasina. Udasina means that objectivity, where you don't take it on. You don't take another person's anger or their own problems in onto yourself. You're able to keep them outside. It took me years to even know what Swamiji meant by that, keeping people outside. But it means that they're outside. You can stay in relationship with them. They haven't entered inside of you so that you're taken on their emotional state. Like somebody says ninda and is angry and critical of you, you swallow it, and then it's inside of you and you are suffering that, rather than it's something that they are experiencing. You don't have to take it on. That's keeping them outside. But to do that, you need that udasina, that kind of objectivity. And to have that objectivity, you have to have a self that's inviolate. The mind has to be sitting in that inviolate self. And you realize as all that's coming at you, that nothing's happening to you at all. Nothing. That's an important thing to realize. That you're exactly the same as all of this praise is coming in, and as all of this censure is also coming in. You're actually exactly the same. And then you can deal objectively with it. You know? And it's not that you have to try to... This is another important thing. It's not that you have to try to stay the same. That's not it, because then you become kind of stone-like. Let me not respond. Not that. It's recognizing that you are the same, no matter what happens. That nothing is happening to you, in fact. And you have to recognize the reality of that. And then there's a tremendous freedom in that. That your being is not being elated when you're praised. Your mind might be, you know, but your being is exactly the same, and it is always whole and complete. In fact, you are what you seek in life. What you're trying to become in life, that is who you are. That has to be recognized. Okay, we'll do the third. This is really a set of three, but we'll do the next. Next time. Maybe we'll finish this next time. We only have three verses left. So.
Let's stop here, though.
I'll just take a minute. Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Say that it's the manas primarily that gets lost in the gunas, kind of, and identified with them, and Buddhi notices that?
No, well, actually, I would say that the manas really is all of these fluctuating thoughts, and so the manas could be very rajasic, or the manas could be more sattvic, or the manas could be, sattvic means the manas is kind of still, you know, or it becomes very dull. The buddhi is the one who discriminates. And so if the buddhi doesn't have knowledge, the intellect doesn't have knowledge, it can't discern, you know, between the atma, the self, and the state of mind. And so, in fact, when that's the case, the buddhi then will take on the conditions of the manas. Like, say the mind is agitated, the buddhi will say, I am agitated. The buddhi that has knowledge will say, we can say the mind is agitated, the manas is agitated, or the rajas is taking over, or whatever it wants to say. It's able to discriminate, because it can differentiate itself from the state, from the whatever the condition is, the sattva, rajas, and tamas. And it recognizes, for one who has knowledge, it recognizes its own, the nature of its own self, which is the Atma. So you're actually dividing the buddhi up into buddhi and manas. You know, buddhi would be the intellect, or the one who has knowledge. And the manas is all of the fluctuating moods and emotions and things that are, and also perceptions, all of the things that are passing through, especially the moods and emotions.
And you're saying that there isn't any distance between consciousness and a thought. I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, it's hard to feel the truth of that, because you think about like the koshas, or even drisho, you talk about going more inward. It feels like there's a lot of, at least, imagining some inner quality to that.
I know. But you know what? That is exactly the weakness of drisho, see or seeing. Because when we think of see or seeing, I am here, and the seen is here, and there's some kind of space in between. Where here, there is no space in between, but the see or seeing is in terms of innermost, what can be objectified, and what remains as the subject. So for instance, if I can say, through my eyes, I objectify this body. This body is known because of my sense organs, right? So my sense organs become the subject, the seer, to the seen body, right? Because I can objectify the body through, and so the sense organs get this title of being subject, so seer, seeing. The same with my mind is aware of my sense organs. And so then the mind becomes innermost in terms of the subject, and the sense organs become external. But it's not like the mind is here and the sense organs are there. The mind and the sense organs, the mind totally uses the sense organs. There's no distance. So it's in terms of innermost, in what I can differentiate in terms of subject-object. So when you get to the self, the mind itself can be objectified. I had this thought, I had this thought, I had this feeling, I had this feeling. The I thought, I am doing this, those are all objectified. So now the self becomes innermost. But it's not innermost in terms like a pea in a pod, or, you know, where the self is interior and this is exterior. It has to do with objectification. But with objectification, the consciousness is never away from what is objectified. Like, for instance, just to think of it like this, I am looking at that painting, okay? Now, my eyes, this body, and these eyes that are the instrument for being able to see the painting, there's a difference in distance. These eyes are 10 feet from the painting, right? But the consciousness of the painting, consciousness is not 10 feet from the painting, right? Without consciousness, the painting is not known, right? So the painting is in consciousness. You can't separate. But when you're within this duality, I think, well, my eyes are 10 feet from the painting, my body is 10 feet from the painting, I'm 10 feet from the painting, subject-object, right? But when we get to consciousness, like, consciousness is not 10 feet from the mind. Now, the mind is not 10 feet from the sense organs, see what I mean? And consciousness is not 10 feet from anything. There is no distance between consciousness and whatever the experience is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's almost like, I don't know, I think even meditatively sometimes it's like, it's a feeling that I have sometimes though, that like you're sort of going inward, you know?
Well, you do feel that way because you're relaxing the body and your sense organs are withdrawing from this external world.
Yeah.
So there is a withdrawal. The mind also, so you're relaxing the body so it becomes less visible, less noticeable. You're pulling the sense organs in, right? And then you're relaxing your mind. So the sense organs are being shut down. And now it's just you and your mind, so to speak. And now you're pulling your mind in. So this in-out has to do with my relationship with the external world. I'm withdrawing my sense organs from its relationship with the external world. And then the mind itself, I'm relaxing and turning that inward. It means into its own being. Does that make sense? Answer what you're
saying? Yeah. It's just, it's language.
It's language. Yeah, we have to always be working with language. Yeah. And redefining language also, because our language is meant for duality.
Yeah.
You know, it functions in duality. So we're always having to use language and break through the dual aspects of language. And that's the whole teaching methodology is about that, learning how to do that. And the reason we can do it is because yourself is present. Even though it's non-objectifiable, it's not present like an object, it's present as the very nature of you, the subject. And so you can use language to point to it, have the mind, to point the mind in the direction, to recognize, to do that viveka, that discrimination. You know? But we have to use language carefully for that, and your students will always surprise you. They'll always surprise you with how they had interpreted your language. You know, because you had thought that, oh, that's right. You can be, like what Michael said the other day. What?
The counter
of experience.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely, I mean, counter does mean that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is, and you kind of rely on your students to continually. That's why the satsang and question answer is so important. Because the words that we have are defined within duality. And so the teacher is always trying to be clever, to be clever and careful, you know, to break through that.
Well, is there a better way to talk about the non-dual then?
That's what we're doing it, the way that to do it. But you just become more sophisticated. You know, you become more sophisticated in the way what you're saying can be misinterpreted. And then you just correct it. You go on correcting.
Hmm.
And the student, in your own mind, the student also goes on correcting. Oh, this is what you meant. Yeah. Oh, this is, I mean, I remember years of doing that with Swamiji. That's what he meant. Or hearing something that he had said, maybe hundreds of times, I finally hear it. And then I realize he said this for so long, but I never really heard it. Yeah.
You know, this sense of meanness, I mean of sameness, which is this, is sort the being is a source of that sense. When the mind is, say, volatile,
yeah.
That sense of meanness, that sense of sameness seems to be covered or non-existent.
It isn't, though. That's just because you're, for some time, for however long, you generally, will think of your own presence in reference to a calm mind. So I'm present when my mind is calm. because you're comparing one type of thought against another type of thought. And when this type of thought is there, then I'm present. But what we need to do is go more, instead of laterally like this, we need to go in depth and recognize that the content of this agitated thought, I'm as much present here to recognize my own presence in all of the thoughts. An agitated thought, a calm thought, doesn't matter what the thought is, my being is fully present and is not covered at all. So I have to get used to that. And as the mind gets used to that over some time, this is why contemplation is good and just repeated shravana, that just becomes natural. So what it would be is you may not want an agitated mind, so your mind is agitated. It might not be your choice. You know, But it's your being is not covered at all, ever. The reason that it feels covered is because you're looking for a shantavritti. You're not recognizing the inviolate, stable presence of yourself amidst this agitated vritti.
Right.
And one of the reasons for this part of it is just the shravana until that becomes clear. But another thing is when we're still doing a lot of inner child work and the agitation has some punch to it, you know, some real affect to it, then the feeling on the part of the mind is, well, who cares about Brahman? What Brahman? What knowledge? Because this pain is beckoning the mind. And so when that's the case, what needs to be done is we need to learn how to do that type of inner child work and learn how to kind of calm the mind down on a different level. Because it needs some psychological attention.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what if a wise person has a firmness in his wisdom, the mind becomes volatile. Will he be able to notice the sameness of being,
mm-hmm.
even in this volatile condition?
Yeah. But we'll also have the skill. I would say like this, yes, definitely. But say there's a lot of affect or whatnot, there's a volatile condition, it's got also affect, emotion, and the darkness of hurt emotion and all that kind of stuff in it. Then that wise person has to have the skill to handle, you know, to calm down that emotion, to do that inner child work or whatever is, whatever tools you have and that we learn in class and whatnot to handle and to resolve that type of emotional eruption. But yourself is not going to be covered by it. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But you still need to do the work to handle that emotional.
But in saying that eruption, notice his well-being?
If you bothered to think about it,
you
notice your own presence is always there, and it is what it is. So it's always the well-being. But the thing is that when there's the emotional upheaval, what is calling your attention at that time is the emotional upheaval,
mm-hmm.
and so then what is automatically called by that is bringing in that kind of kind voice, you know. And that's what is needed for that emotional upheaval. So that should come first, just automatically. The self of that, yourself is ever present there. And that's aparoksha. That doesn't go away. But what is called to the aid of the upset one, you know, is the one who can come in and give some comfort. If that's necessary. If it's not necessary, then the inner child problems are not so intense. And then you can just pull your mind back into your own self and let it relax. Somehow it got pulled out into samsara, and got taken on a ride, but it's not a big deal. You can just come back home. But sometimes when there's still a lot of hurt or problems inside, you need to handle it on a more psychological level, and we have the tools to do that. You know, it's like if you hurt your body, you have to take care of it. Like if it's just a little cut, you just go wash it off and it'll be fine, you know? If it's a bigger cut, you have to do a little bit more. If you break your arm, you have to do a little bit more. You have to deal with the problem at hand. And so same with your mind and the level of type of upset it is. Some upsets are nothing. You can just blow them off. They have that verse in the Gita where some of the desires or agitations that come through are just kind of like smoke. You can, and it's fine, it's nothing. Other types of desires or hurts or agitations are more like dirt on a mirror, and those makes a little bit more work. And other hurts or agitations or desires are more like a fetus in a womb. Those are the three. A fetus in a womb needs a lot more care. It has to be held, it has to go through, it has to be born, it has to go through a birth, and it takes time. Mm-hmm. The main thing, I think, for us is to have the different levels of skill, you know, to be able to handle the different types of problems appropriately, to give them a chance to be freed of, especially childhood problems, to learn how to be with all of that in such a way that, you know, that all of that inner hurt can be transformed and released.
Yeah, because some of those affects can seem to last a lifetime. I mean, you know, always be there.
Well, I think that the unconscious is like that. The unconscious doesn't have any sense of time. So, you know, once they're always there until you actually go in and perform the rescue operation. You know, because otherwise they just sit there and will endlessly respond, be triggered. But nobody's gone in to transform them, to help. You have to kind of go inside and, you know, re-raise those parts, come into relationship with them. You know, in therapy we do that with our clients. The therapist can have that relationship kind of becomes the good parent to the unconscious, and the therapist can get internalized, you know, and then there's an inner dialogue that goes on. Or we can learn how to do that ourselves. You can be in therapy and you learn how to do that from your therapist, or you can in class now we talk about that all quite a bit, how to go inside and be with those ones inside. But then that's something that's not just knowledge, that's something you have to learn and then do. With Vedanta, self-knowledge is like holding up a mirror, you see it, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
The knowing is the liberation itself. But inner child work and something is kind of like learning how to cook, and then you have to go cook. But learning how to be with the little ones inside, then you have to actually go and do that.
So then an action is required.
Yeah.
But otherwise an action is not required.
In terms of self-knowledge, yourself is already present. The only problem is this veil of ignorance, right? And so when you, as you gain knowledge, I mean, knowledge is liberation because yourself is already free. But we're talking about here, in terms of inner child work or psychological work, there's something that needs to be healed, that needs to be done.
Like if a soldier had post-traumatic stress and then heard a car backfiring.
Exactly. But something has to be worked through, you know, to take care of that.
I thought it was very interesting that you said that there's no time in the unconscious, that it just sits.
Yeah, there's no sense of time. Yeah.
You mentioned Sunday and many other times as a practice, and I've been doing it, which is, this is kind of related. You know, saying to oneself, everything okay?
Yeah.
Am I still here? In all kinds of situations. And I've been doing that. And sometimes, you know, well, the answer is always yes.
Mm-hmm.
then there's a sense of...
It better be.
Yeah. Then there's a sense of, you know, me.
Well.
And, but sometimes to get to that point is slower and kind of more thick, and it's a more hazy, you know, sense of the presence. And so what occurred to me when I was thinking about this, I mean, sometimes it's more extreme and it's the inner child stuff. And,
yeah.
Okay, we just talked about that. But sometimes it's not quite as intense as that. And what came up, you know, I thought, well, there's something else you've said sometime in the past couple of months, I think, if I understood properly, and it was that the Dehatma Buddhi is so strong, the identification with the body, you know, that seems to be what's going on. That's the when it's tougher to connect. There's some kind of body thing. And... It's so strong because of the kinesthetic awareness.
You know, I see, yeah. Uh-huh.
Physical feelings.
Yeah. Especially if you're...
They're so close in a certain way that it's hard to, you know... And so I wondered if you could say something about working with that kind of stuff. I mean, is it just repetition?
I think that, say, if you can...
That's the hardest nut to crack.
But if you can, if you're able to go from the haziness to that kind of self-recognition, just as a kind of a practice throughout the day, sometimes it's very easy. Oh yeah, you know. But you just keep doing that. There comes a time when you realize that you're always here and nothing can ever do anything about it. You just keep working at it. If say you have a reaction, you know, if you have an emotional reaction. That always is in the body. If you have, the affect is in the body, right? And so sometimes that takes a while for that to go away, and it may be hard initially for you to differentiate your own presence from that embodied reaction.
That's exactly.
Yeah. So just notice that. But after some time, you'll start getting used to the fact that yes, you in as you are always present, no matter what is going on. And so you just keep trying that. You know, it's good to do nididhyasana. Nididhyasana means meditation. Meditation means where you really bring your mind back. You know, you can sit with yourself and just bring your mind back through some of these meditative exercises just so that yourself comes more to the forefront. And then just sit with yourself. Get your mind gets used to you, to who you are. You know, and then you start noticing that you're never not there. That's the important thing. And that's why you use meditation, just to get to a place of being able to recognize that changeless presence of your being. And then you can use questions like, what am I like, really? What is this? What am I like? Why is it called the beloved? These are really important questions to throw to your mind when you're sitting in contemplation. What is beloved about me, the simple me? You know, then you say, at some point it dawns on you that actually there is nothing more beloved, more important than this. And that, then you understand what they mean by ananda. But that's kind of like a little light bulb. For me, that was a little light bulb that went off. I realized.
Could you say that coming to the forefront is a little bit like when, I don't know if you've ever seen these, but there are these drawings or paintings or artwork.
Oh yeah, I've seen
them. If you look at
them
a certain way, and then they become
all
3D,
sudden,
but you have to do something with your eye, and it's sort of like it pulls out, pops out. Sometimes it's real fast, sometimes it's slow, but...
What's he talking about?
That's what I...
You may not have seen those, but they have these very complex pictures. They look like just a very busy design, but if you stare at it just right for a while, you'll see it's a three-dimensional...
It doesn't work for me. No.
You know, but I've seen those. They're amazing.
Yeah.
In a way,
when you actually see it.
You see it. But here, it's like that in that you see something that you've always seen, you recognize something that you have always seen. You just didn't see it, but you've always seen it. You know, but it's not an objectification. It's just recognizing the self that has always been there, but you'd never differentiated it from all of the other experience. And now the same self that had been totally pervasive to all the other emotional, mental experiences now is standing alone. You recognize it as something which is actually not sullied or hurt or changed by all of the other experience. But it's always been there. So it's not a new experience. You just recognize that it's always there and it's always free.
And it seems like it's also very simple, in a sense.
Very simple. It couldn't be more simple. That's part of the problem. Swamiji laughed about that once. I said, this is early on, I said something like, Swamiji, this is really simple, isn't it? And he laughed and he said, that is the problem. Mm-hmm. It's so simple that we have to unwind and unwind and unwind because our mind is complex.
Yeah.
So you have to unwind just to get back just to the basic you recognition.
Because to have a discovery, you think that the mind has to find this challenger, solve a big thing.
Yeah, something that's unknown to be gained, but it's not. It's already present.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Are we done? We are.